You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
It is 2020. It's 250 years since Beethoven was born. So I decided we needed to have one Beethoven service this year. And I'm going to ask Margaret to start with the prelude. I'd like to welcome everybody. We're a little bit spaced out, as in socially distanced. We won't be doing any singing today, but the service will be pretty much the same as otherwise, apart from that. We meet here on Kaurna land and we acknowledge the elders past and present. We also honour the current Kaurna elders. And the other group that we have a bit to do with here is Piramank people. Those of you who went to Beau's funeral would have seen Ivan Copley doing a smoking ceremony, and he's one of the Piramank people. Piramank and Kaurna lands actually overlap. I hope you enjoy the service today. It's a bit of a special one, honouring Beethoven, and I chose to do a whole service about him because he experienced such social isolation because of his deafness, and many people can't attend the funerals or weddings or parties of their family members, and we are suffering from that social isolation even if we're not in dire fear of getting COVID-19 ourselves. And there are a few other reasons which I'll leave for the address itself to emerge. In 1804, Beethoven completed his masterful Third Symphony. It's big and bold from those striking opening chords, and so the audience know they're in for something big. It was only appropriate that this magnificent symphony was dedicated to someone of equal importance. And who better than to dedicate your symphony to, your best work, than to your idol? For Beethoven, there was no question that his own hero was Napoleon Bonaparte. That should be the dedicatee. At least until he realised that his own personal hero, Napoleon, he's nothing but an ordinary being. Now he will trample the rights of man underfoot and pander to his own ambition. He scratched out Napoleon's name from the dedication page, tore it up, and retitled it Sinfonia Eroica, for the true heroes of the world. And I was going to leave the kids with the question, who do you think the true heroes of the world are today? Celebrating 250 years of Beethoven. Born 1770, 250 years ago, a quarter of a millennium. 2020 was to be defined as the big year of Beethoven's celebration. Who would have thought COVID would take over? I heard Beethoven's Ninth in January in Melbourne and then came upon Maren Allsop's Six Continent Project, working with Indigenous and local people to augment the symphony with newly imagined content. It started in Brazil, in Sao Paulo, last December. I tuned in. OSESB is a favourite orchestra of mine, and the Brazilian interpolations into the score were exhilarating. In preparation for the December concerts, more than 22,000 students across Sao Paulo engaged with Ode to Joy through their OSESB school programs and learnt about Beethoven's life and music, as well as the events of Brazil's history during Beethoven's lifetime. I promptly booked my tickets for Sydney in August and was tempted to go to New Zealand for the Maori editions. Maren Allsop said, "A global ode to joy recasts Beethoven's Ninth Symphony as a 21st century call for unity, justice, and empowerment, presenting a rare opportunity for major musical institutions to join in a global conversation." Well, 'twas not to be. The pandemic put an end to creative workshops as well as international travel. Maren Allsop was confined to her apartment in Baltimore doing Zoom conferences, of what fun they are. A tentative back-to-business model is operating in Europe now. Recently, Allsop began in Paris with Beethoven's first piano concerto, which isn't very often played, actually. Throughout November, Natalie Stutzmann will present all the Beethoven symphonies in Kristiansand in Norway to literally spaced out audiences. Last month, I heard Christine Gerke sing one of the wonderful arias from Beethoven's Fidelio at the steps at the Lincoln Center with a grand piano. Abscheulicher, wo eilst du hin? Was hast du vor im wilden Grimme? Abominable one! Where are you going? What will you do in wild anger? Now, this was a tribute to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a great opera devotee and a promoter of the art form, but I think the first verse is rather more about Donald Trump. The second verse brings to mind Ginsburg herself, and I'll just do the translation. Come, hope. Let the last star from fatigue not fade. Illuminate my goal, even if it's distant. Love will reach it. I follow an inner drive. I will not waver. My duty strengthens me. And that's the Beethoven I revered so much in my student years. Think of late 60s, early 70s, my bedroom wall posters, Albert Einstein and Greta Garbo. Albert suffered a mishap when I peeled him off the wall in Mount Gambier, so Greta remained behind with my sister to be joined by some Pre-Raphaelites and Simon and Garfunkel, and I bought a new poster for my student Diggs in Adelaide. Beethoven, in the perpetual bad hair day portrait, so familiar to us all. I joined Len Amadio's little team of youth concerts volunteers, sold programmes and listened to a lot more Beethoven. In German 1A, we read the story of Beethoven ripping the title page off the Symphony No. 3 in anger at Napoleon, proclaiming himself the emperor. Beethoven, champion of democracy in an undemocratic age. So what? What was new? Well, at the time of the terror following the French Revolution, Haydn composed the military symphony. It's decorous, jolly even, and not to the modern ear, particularly warlike. It recalls rather the Bennett girls gushing over the officers in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. In the Vienna of the 1790s, music had become more and more the favourite pastime of a cultured aristocracy for whom politics had become both discreditable and dangerous. Many played instruments themselves well enough to take their place alongside professionals. Probably at no other time, in no other city, was there such a high standard of amateur and semi-professional music making as in Vienna in Beethoven's day. Now, Beethoven was born into a family of downwardly mobile musicians. Grandpa Ludwig van B had been a Kapellmeister at Bonn. His less talented father, Johann, failed to win that post and descended into alcoholism. He beat young Ludwig to make him practice, shut him in the cellar, and arrived home late at night drunk and made him play. If you read stories about Michael Jackson as a little boy, or Macaulay Culkin, you see how little the world has changed in some respects. Parents still abuse talented kids in pursuit of money and fame. It is still rampant in the art and sports. Johann failed to mould him into a Mozartian child prodigy, probably just as well, if you look at how those two ended up. Young Ludwig did become assistant court organist, and his teacher discussed Enlightenment ideals with the local intellectuals. Ludwig was keen to get away, and he visited Vienna first as a teenager. Tragically, this visit was cut short by the death of his mother. When he left Bonn for good in 1792, his Bonn friends signed an autograph book for him. Patron Count Wallstein wrote, "With the help of unceasing diligence, you will receive the spirit of Mozart from the hands of Haydn." Now, listening to the ABC last week, I found out that Beethoven ghost wrote for Wallstein, who was more than happy to take the credit. So I guess he owed him a big compliment. But he kind of got it right, didn't he? In Vienna, Beethoven was a piano virtuoso, and he studied composition with Haydn. There we go, there's Haydn. In the time of the terror, wisely, he wrote like Haydn and Mozart, but his works aren't infused with horror or political idealism, which is just as well, because Vienna, under reactionary Emperor Francis II, was not Bonn with its high-minded discussions about the Enlightenment ideals. And no one thought he should be engaging with the turmoil of the world. The American Revolution was done and dusted. The French one was in the pipeline. The purpose of music wasn't to engage with the bloody world. The world was unhygienic, brutal, and exploitative. No one wanted their noses rubbed in the world. If you think of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro and the abduction from the Seraglio, they contained some salacious and sordid stuff. But Mozart seemed to say, "There, there, that revolution stuff won't happen here. Here we celebrate beauty and all that is good and noble and decorous. Now, Bach may have taken a bit of a dim view of this. He served the church. Music was there to exalt the Lord and to ennoble mankind. It wasn't there to pander to, indulge, and soothe the aristocracy. What's more, music was intellectually stimulating. Bach didn't write in a mere handful of keys, like most composers in subsequent periods. He composed preludes and fugues for all 24 major and minor keys, for the profit and use of musical youth desirous of learning, especially for the pastime of those already skilled in this study. Mozart was not at the beck and call of archbishops. He became a freelancer and impresario, not a Kapellmeister. And Beethoven was to follow suit. So not for them, the well-tempered clavier. They needed to write stuff that was engaging for all. And they employed tricks. The Mannheim Rocket thrilled audiences with its exploitation of the dynamics of the piano forte, soft, loud. And of course that could be done with the orchestra as well. Mannheim was a city in Germany which had a whopping great orchestra for the standards of the day, and a composer, Stamitz, who knew how to write for people who didn't have a prodigious musical education. Mozart went to Mannheim, so did Haydn. Stamitz knew if you crafted one nice musical phrase, it was a jolly good idea to repeat it straight away. Bother postponing gratification. You gave the audience what they wanted, what they needed, because you needed a paying audience. Well, Haydn did a bit more than this. He defined the symphony. He took the idea of proportion and balance, and instead of just repeating a phrase for symmetry, he tweaked it. So phrase one will be repeated with the same shape but slightly different notes. And then a third phrase will combine the first two and ornament them, and it's all going somewhere. It's all developing. The symphony grew to contain several movements, 6 to 8 minutes long, different speeds. Little musical ideas are woven into a much larger structure, and that's the point of a symphony. It's like an essay or a very long doodle that shows you where you can get if you start with a few good little bits of tune. It's truly a remarkable thing. An exploration of musical ideas with no plot, no story. A body out the front, coordinating, beating time with the right hand, indicating dynamics or suggesting colour with the left, face and body adding interpretive clues, but no literal meaning. No obvious descriptions of anything, 60 musicians simultaneously creating an abstract work of art, really. And this is a century before abstraction emerged in either painting or sculpture. And abstraction probably saved many a musician's bacon over the years. Opera, by contrast, is literal and explicit, and therefore politically perilous. Fidelio, Beethoven's only opera, is a rescue story. Leonora's husband, Florestan, was imprisoned by a cruel dictator, Pizarro, and his wife disguises herself as a boy, called Fidelio, to get a job in the Nick. Well, by the end, all the prisoners get rescued, and the finale is 17 minutes of high-minded rejoicing. Heil sei dem Tag, heil sei die Stunde. Well, there are a lot of French soldiers in the audience, and they didn't like it much. Well, they didn't like German opera anyway. But this one was really, really irritating. Vienna was occupied by the French at the time. Beethoven and theatre management argued, and the result was no more performances for 8 years. Beethoven reworked it, reduced it to 2 acts, and it's still performed today, and it's still performed with political intent. Fast forward to World War II, whip over the Atlantic. Toscanini was convinced that Beethoven would have loathed Hitler and Mussolini, and Fidelio was the first opera performance to be broadcast in 1944 at the Met in New York. Fidelio was also the first opera to be performed after World War II in Berlin, in the only undamaged theatre, Theater des Westens, under the baton of Robert Hager. Furtwängler, another conductor, said, "Fidelio has more of the mass than of an opera to it. The sentiment it expresses come from the sphere of the sacred and preach a religion of humanity, which we never found so beautiful or necessary as we do today, after all we've lived through. Herein lies the singular power of this unique opera. Independent of any historical consideration, the flaming message of Fidelio touches us deeply. We realize, for us Europeans, as for all men, this music will always represent an appeal to our conscience." And a third example is as recently as the 7th of October, 1989. The occasion? The 40th anniversary of the DDR. A production of Fidelio in Dresden coincided with violent demonstrations at the city's main train station. The applause after the prisoners' chorus interrupted the performance for a considerably long time, and the production by Christi Militz had the chorus appear in normal street clothes at the end, signifying their role as representatives of the audience. 4 weeks later, on the 9th of November, 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall signalled the end of East Germany's regime. In freier Luft den Atem leicht zu heben. It's easy to breathe in free air. The first symphony that really shrieks, "I am Beethoven, not Mozart or Haydn," is the third, the Eroica. The first movement alone is as long as an early Haydn symphony. The second movement, which is a funeral march, is incredibly serious. So different in tone. Grief is grief. Loss is loss. Pain is pain. The reality of suffering is there. The lily is not gilded. Music was no longer about faith, beauty, and elegance, but was rooted in feelings and responses to the world. Music was now about the sadness and fear people might actually be feeling, as indeed it was with J.S. Bach in the Baroque period, if you think of cantatas like Erbarme dich, Have Mercy on Me. Beethoven subsumed his personality into the music. The music was about his psychology and nature all around him. Nature was ascribed human emotions. It became a metaphor for the feelings of the composer. The Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral, served as a template for the next century for how states of mind could be portrayed by pictures of nature. Schubert really picked this ball up and ran with it in his wonderful song cycles. So, apart from surviving a grim childhood, becoming an idealist, a champion of freedom and justice, a writer of fabulous symphonies, sonatas and songs, an opera, an inspiration for composers to write emotively, why else should we connect with Beethoven? Why else should we be in awe? Well, I guess it's how he handled the essential tragedy of his life. And I'm going to ask Barbara Willow to read the letter he wrote to his brothers in 1802, to be read after he was dead. It was known as the Heiligenstadt Testament. So it was written in 1802 and not read until 1827.
For my brothers, Karl and Johann Beethoven. Oh, you men who think or say that I'm malevolent, stubborn, misanthropic, how greatly do you wrong me? You do not know the secret cause which makes me seem that way to you. From childhood on, my heart and soul have been full of the tender feeling of goodwill. But think that for 6 years now I've been hopelessly afflicted, made worse by senseless physicians, from year to year deceived with hopes of improvement, finally compelled to face the prospect of a lasting malady, whose cure will take years or perhaps be impossible. Though born with a fiery, active temperament, even susceptible to the diversions of society, I was soon compelled to isolate myself, to live life alone. If at times I tried to forget all of this, oh, how harshly was I flung back to the doubly sad experience of my bad hearing. Yet it was impossible for me to say to people, "Speak louder, shout, for I am deaf." Ah, how could I possibly admit an infirmity in the one sense, which ought to be more perfect in me than others? A sense which I once possessed in the highest perfection, a perfection such as few in my profession enjoy or ever have enjoyed. Oh, I cannot do it. Therefore, forgive me when you see me draw back, when I would have gladly mingled with you. My misfortune is doubly painful to me, because I am bound to be misunderstood. To me, there can be no relaxation with my fellow men, no refined conversations, no mutual exchange of ideas. I must also live alone, like one who's been banished. I can mix with society only as much as true necessity demands. If I approach near to people, a hot terror seizes upon me, and I fear being exposed to the danger that my condition might be noticed. Thus it has been during the last 6 months which I've spent in the country. By ordering me to spare my hearing as much as possible, my intelligent doctor almost fell in with my own present frame of mind, though sometimes I ran counter to it by yielding to my desire for companionship. But what a humiliation for me when someone standing next to me heard a flute in the distance, and I heard nothing. Or someone standing next to me heard a shepherd singing, and again, I heard nothing. Such incidents drove me almost to despair. A little more of that, and I would have ended my life. It was only my art that held me back. Ah, it seemed to me impossible to leave the world until I'd brought forth all that I felt was within me. Patience, they say, is what I must now choose for my guide, and I have done so. I hope my determination will remain firm, to endure until it pleases the fates to break the thread. Perhaps I shall get better, perhaps not. I'm ready. Forced to become a philosopher already in my 28th year. Oh, it's not easy. Divine One, thou seest my inmost soul. Thou knowest that therein dwells the love of mankind and the desire to do good. You, my brothers, Carl and Johann, as soon as I am dead, if Dr. Schmidt is still alive, ask him in my name to describe my malady and attach this written documentation to his account of my illness, so that so far as it is possible, at least the world may become reconciled to me after my death. At the same time, I declare you two to be the heirs to my small fortune. Divide it fairly, bear with, and help each other. To you, Brother Carl, I give special thanks for the attachment you've shown me of late. It's my wish that you may have a better and freer life than I've had. Recommend virtue to your children. It alone, not money, can make them happy. I speak from experience. This is what's upheld me in time of misery. Thanks to it and my art, I did not end my life by suicide. Farewell, and love each other. I thank all my friends. I would like the instruments of Prince Lichovsky to be preserved by one of you, but not to be the cause of strife between you. And as soon as they can serve you a better purpose, then sell them. How happy I shall be. If I can still be helpful to you in my grave, so be it. With joy I hasten toward death. If it comes before I've had the chance to develop all my artistic capacities, it will still be coming too soon, despite my harsh fate. And I should probably wish it later. Yet even so I should be happy, for would it not free me from a state of endless suffering? Come thou wilt, I shall meet thee bravely. Farewell, and do not wholly forget me when I'm dead. I deserve this from you, for during my lifetime I was thinking of you often, and of ways to make you happy. Be so. Ludwig van Beethoven, Heiligenstadt, October the 6th, 1802.
Well, after the Ninth Symphony, which is Beethoven's supreme expression of joy, the love of humanity, and the brotherhood of man, Beethoven turned within, leaving others like Brahms and Mahler to write epic symphonies. He left the task of reforming humanity to the scores of younger composers. By this time, he could hear nothing. He was often bedridden with severe illness. His sound world resided wholly within. He wrote 6 string quartets of astonishing intensity and modernity, even by the standards of composers 100 years hence. They seem very private and are suffused with almost unbearable sadness. They underpin our tormented diva view of Beethoven. The last quartets went far beyond the comprehension of musicians and audiences in Beethoven's day. One musician commented, "We know there is something there, but we do not know what it is." And composer Louis Spohr called them indecipherable, uncorrected horrors. Opinion has changed considerably from the time of their first bewildered reception. These 6 quartets comprise Beethoven's last major completed compositions and are widely considered to be among the greatest of all times. Certainly, they're a huge challenge for the future practitioners of chamber music, whether they're composers or players. Now, I am enjoying my Beethoven this year, despite the big disappointment of the cancellation of major projects, the modification and remoteness of delivery of concerts. But that's life, isn't it? You want to make God laugh? Tell her your plans. We don't know what's round the corner. And as for Beethoven himself, what an inspiration. What a humanist, lover of humanity, and what resilience. I've touched on 3 Beethovens today. The young virtuoso who wanted to play for people, not just the aristocracy or not just in church. We've had the idealist saviour of humanity and the reflective suffering soul. No wonder 10,000 people attended his funeral. It's amazing, isn't it? And no wonder also he has not been forgotten by his brothers or anyone else. I must thank Barbara Willow from the bottom of my heart for her wonderful, tender reading of Beethoven's letter to his brothers. And finally, I thank Margaret Lambert, who brings us closer to Beethoven with her piano than anyone can do with mere words. Recommend virtue to your children. It alone, not money, can make them happy.
I speak from experience. That was from the Heiligenstadt testimony. Don't only practice your art, force your way into its secrets. Art deserves that, for it and knowledge can raise man to the divine.
Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.